Hello, it's March 31st, 2024. My name is Simone, and this is 90s Crime Time. Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time. And if you're new to 90s Crime Time, welcome to the show. Like always, I hope you all have had a great week so far and are looking forward to the weekend. And, well, since I've been slacking in the past and wanted to make up for it, I don't really want to do a lot of preface for this episode because I might as well just go ahead and dive right into this episode. So, with that, let's dive in to today's case. The year was 1994, and in the bluegrass region of the state of Kentucky was the city of Lexington. Back in that year, Lexington had around 250,000 people residing here, and was coined the horse capital of the world. This was because amongst the bluegrass roamed many horses who were well kept and beautiful, and who were owned by some of the wealthiest in all the area. However, these horses weren't just any old pet. Most were for horse shows around the area for their owners to boast about to fellow competitors and spectators. People from around the world would come and watch horses and their jockeys compete for top prizes, which could include lots of cash, and back then, many liked to watch and participate in top horse shows, which included the three-day event or the national reigning championship. However, if horses weren't a lot of the natives' interest, there were a lot of other things for them to do in a city of this size. But many liked to celebrate their hometown teams at their local University of Kentucky, called the Wildcats. Here at this wide university, many liked to cheer on all teams of the Wildcats, but mostly cheered on the football team, even if they didn't win a lot of their games. Because no matter what, Lexington natives and people from the surrounding areas were going to cheer on their team. However, in the summer of 1994, the fans of the Wildcats football team and the city as a whole would be shocked when tragedy struck to one of their players. And after a period of time, the fans would find out why this tragedy occurred. In the following case, you'll find out the tragic event that took place, the investigation, and the shocking aftermath in a case I title, One-Sided Feud. On the evening of July 17, 1994, a small crowd of close student friends from the University of Kentucky gathered at an off-campus house to celebrate a friend's almost 21st birthday. As the night went on, the friends were just relaxing with drinks and some laughter, when sometime that night, when more of the lady partygoers were outside, a pickup truck packed with young men drove by and catcalled at them. In response, many of the men sternly ordered them away, and the men drove off. Back at the party, as the late hours carried on, many of the partiers left to go other places. And one of the occupants of the home, Antonio O'Farrell, and the quarterback of the University of Lexington's football team, was heading to bed around 2:30 in the morning when he heard a loud bang. Following the bang, Antonio heard some of the partygoers that were left outside crying and screaming. Meanwhile, outside, after they heard the bang, the partygoers looked around to see if everything was okay, and some thought it was a nearby car backfiring. But after they looked around again, they saw the birthday boy slumped over in his chair outside on the porch, bleeding from his head. 911 was immediately called, and after paramedics assessed the scene and checked him out, they declared him dead. At around 3 a.m., just 3 days before his 21st birthday, and he was identified as 20-year-old Trent DeGiro, a University of Kentucky Wildcats football player. According to reports, Trent DeGiro was born July 20, 1973, in Goshen, Kentucky, to Mike and Ann DeGiro. And even from birth, Trent's parents knew he was going places due to his abnormally large weight as a baby. Reports state Trent was born 10 pounds and 9 ounces. And by the time he was brought home from the hospital, he was already eating infant cereal. As he grew older, his parents figured he'd be great at sports, football to be exact. And by the time Trent was in the fourth grade, he was playing the sport against other boys who were 3 years older than him. As the years went on, Trent continued to play football, where he was acknowledged as being one of the best and ferocious players on the field. But outside the field, he was known as a gentle giant. Reports also state that Trent was nice to his fellow students and lovable with his family. As a matter of fact, at school, if he saw a kid being bullied, due to his large frame, he'd stand up for them and the bully would go away. Also, one person said of him, also due to his large size, you'd think he'd fight a lot, but he was usually the one to break up a fight. Meanwhile, when Trent reached high school at South Oldham High School, he of course played football and went on to become team captain by the time he became a senior in 1990. That same year, the University of Kentucky Wildcats football coach, Bill Glaser, was going around the state scouting for recruits when he went to South Oldham to watch a game and possibly find a potential prized player. Coach Glaser laid his eyes on Trent, and it wasn't the first time he had seen him, because over the summer of 1990, Trent participated in a Wildcat football camp. Coach Glaser had the assessment of Trent as the strong, silent type with a wide body, but not very tall, and he didn't have the right arm length to be a top lineman. But what Coach Glaser did like was that Trent was a go-getter and had fire on the field. Since he was a senior football player thinking of college, Trent was ready to play at the college level, but only smaller surrounding schools had taken an interest in him. Not his dream, Wildcats. However, Trent wanted to prove he had the skill to play at bigger colleges, especially at UK. So, Trent told his father Mike about his dream. And that summer, Mike called Coach Glaser and wanted to know if his son had a chance to ever play for the Wildcats. In which Coach Glaser told him yes. Reports state that after Trent was accepted into the University of Kentucky in 1991, he got to play on the football team, but only on the scout team that goes up against the first string defense on practice. Trent was eventually given the number 67 jersey, but he hadn't played in any official games by 1992. But a report states, quote unquote, at the spring banquet, the team named Trent DeGiro most valuable offensive walk-on. However, reports also state that in 1992, an incident occurred with Trent that almost derailed his college football aspirations. And that was when, in September of 92, Trent got very drunk at UK's university club, knocked a fellow student into a wall, then went outside and smashed windows out of someone's car, for which he was charged for both crimes. Then, later that year, Trent was arrested around Christmas for shoplifting. For his crimes, he pled guilty, paid restitution to his victims, and spent a weekend in jail. Despite his mishaps, by 1993, Trent proved himself able to play in some regular games of the season. But he got a toe injury during a practice one day and missed the opportunity to play at the coveted Peach Bowl college game. Even though it was believed Trent was sent to UK primarily to play football, reports state he also wanted to be a regular college kid too. He sometimes got so tired that people automatically assumed he was a football player because of his large frame. But on the other hand, he sometimes didn't like college outside of football because he struggled a lot with his studies. However, due to his less than perfect grades, this motivated Trent to study harder because he knew most of the Wildcats had to have decent grades to be on the team. And due to his hard studying, Trent brought up his grades, and by his junior year, he was named one of the UK football players named to the SEC honor roll. Going into his senior year, Trent had high expectations for the upcoming season. Reports state he worked very hard on his athletic physique and worked tirelessly on his drills. Because by now, Trent was sure he'd receive a scholarship to play for the team and get his education paid for his senior year. By June of 1997, just before his senior year was to begin. By this point, not only was Trent mastering his football skills, but in the almost 4 years Trent had been in college, he'd made friends with a bunch of people on and off the field. Due to this, for his upcoming 21st birthday, he decided to invite some of these friends to a house party to celebrate. Reports state that on July 16th, a day before his party, Trent went to the gym to do more conditioning. And then later on that day, he called his parents to tell them he'd be home later to celebrate his birthday. His parents told him that they had a present waiting for him, and Trent was so excited to open it soon. The next day, on the 17th, the day of the party, Trent and his buddies were spread throughout the house, chatting about the big game coming up. And some were getting phone numbers from some of the ladies at the party. As the party winded down, Trent sat outside in his brown leather chair and continued to chat with the few friends that were left at the party. When suddenly, his life was taken. After detectives arrived, they started questioning witnesses at the house. And according to an article, witnesses said, quote unquote, "At the end of the evening, Trent was sitting in his recliner on the porch with a few friends chatting. All of a sudden, there was a loud bang, and people thought it was a car backfiring. One of Trent's friends turned to him to ask if he heard it, but Trent was slumped in his chair with blood coming from his ear." Witnesses also stated that no one saw a gun, but everyone heard the shot. They also mentioned the pickup truck of men who catcalled earlier that night. But detectives had no idea who they were and where to find them. After Trent's loved ones back home were unfortunately notified of his murder, they too had no idea who would murder Trent. But they did mention Trent's bar fight from years ago. And they mentioned that Trent had taken a trip to New York City with some friends years before, and he told his friends he had witnessed a murder. Reports state that when he returned to Kentucky after his New York trip, he told his family that he saw some type of shooting and that maybe there was a slim possibility someone from New York came down to Kentucky to kill Trent because he saw too much. However, detectives investigating his murder quickly debunked this theory because it didn't make sense, and Trent more than likely only saw New York police investigating a shooting, not the shooting itself. He was just more than likely shocked by big city crime. However, back at the crime scene, detectives took a close look at where Trent died, his chair. The early theory was that the shooter stepped around the corner of the porch, fired the weapon, and then ran back around the back. However, none of the partygoers who were on the porch with Trent that night saw a gun or a shooter. Even though it was dark outside, someone surely would have seen something if the shooter was that close. At the crime lab, though, ballistics experts showed that the bullet came from a rifle and that the shooter was more than likely at least 60 feet away with pinpoint accuracy, meaning Trent was shot by a skilled marksman. But who? As the months went on, no one could tell detectives why Trent was murdered or who did it, and his case eventually went cold. Every year after the murder, local newspapers would have a special article asking the public for help in naming a suspect and highlighting different aspects of the case, but to no avail. And for the next 2 years, detectives had nothing. That was until the spring of 1996, when police got a peculiar call from a man named David Canty, who said he knew a lot about the case. He seemed credible, and detectives were a little desperate to get answers, so they went to visit him. However, reports state that when they got to David's home, they were taken aback about what was inside. According to reports, David had scribbled notes about the case on dozens of paper plates and had also made his own trajectory calculations on the shot that killed Trent. And what really shocked police was that in David's home was a hunting rifle with the same .243 caliber as the bullet that killed Trent. To detectives, they felt they were getting somewhere because they knew a .243 was a very rare style of rifle. So they thought that bullet in the home could be connected to the murder. But when it was tested by ballistics, police found it was not a match and determined David was not credible. He was just obsessed with the crime. More years went by without any real clues in the murder of Trent. Press conferences were still being made, flyers were posted, and lots of newspaper articles and pleas were published for a very long time, asking for any type of answers. However, in June 1999, reports state a local TV station re-examined the case for a show, and a flurry of calls and tips came in. And the same year, on the fifth anniversary of Trent's murder, his father went on local TV and said simply, quote-unquote, "Somebody knows what happened." And just a short time after Trent's father made his plea, an attorney in Lexington received a call from an old friend who asked for advice. She was vague at first, but she wanted advice on how to report a crime in secrecy. She eventually told the attorney she knew who was behind a high-profile murder. And the attorney knew exactly what she was talking about. Trent's case. So, reports state the attorney went to a detective and told him that the person who killed Trent, from his friend's knowledge, was named Shane Ragland. Not much is publicly known about Shane Ragland, but what is known is that he grew up with very prominent and wealthy parents. In particular, his father Jerry owned a vast amount of property and leased much of it to the state government for office space. As Shane grew older, he had heavy expectations to live up to, but he was known as a bit spoiled. However, some who knew him growing up called him respectful, especially at church, and an average student. During high school, Shane, just like Trent, had his eyes set on the University of Kentucky. It's unclear what he was declaring as his major, but what Shane really wanted to do at UK wasn't necessarily to learn and make great grades. His goal was to gain membership into the elite and sometimes controversial fraternity, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, otherwise known as SAE. So when Shane started at UK in 1991, he was focused on becoming a frat brother and attended many of their rush parties. At one of these parties, Shane came across Trent and one of his buddies named Matt, who was also trying to pledge SAE. According to reports, Trent and Matt were friendly with Shane, and eventually that night, the three young men and others ended up in an old dorm belonging to Trent when he lived on campus. When Shane entered Trent's dorm, he noticed a photo of a girl on the wall that was part of a calendar of fraternity girls. Then, out of the blue, pointed to the girl and said he slept with her. According to reports, though, what Shane wasn't expecting was Trent to tell him off, calling him a liar. You see, The girl Shane claimed to have slept with was the president of SAE's girlfriend, whom Trent considered a friend as well. After Trent told Shane off, word got back to SAE's president, and eventually, Shane was crossed off as a potential candidate for SAE, leaving him angry. However, after learning that he wouldn't be an SAE, Shane thought it was Matt's fault since he was the one also pledging. He had no idea at the time it was Trent who told on him. Shane even threatened Matt with violence due to this. But when Trent learned of this, he went up to Shane and told him himself that he told the SAE president. And once Shane realized Trent was telling the truth, that's when he set his sights in the worst way on Trent. Back at the police station, the attorney told the detective this, and now they thought they were getting somewhere with the case. However, they had to figure out an approach to actually have Shane admit what he had done. They wanted to talk to the woman herself, however, and when they did, she told them she was an ex of Shane, and one night in 1994, they were joking around with each other when she asked him what was the craziest thing he'd ever done. And he said that he had killed Trent DeGiro. At first, she thought he was still joking, but it seemed as if what Shane had told her felt like a relief, and he even showed her the rifle he'd used. She said she decided to keep Shane's confession a secret for years, even after they broke up. But after seeing Trent's parents on TV, she came forward. She then agreed to work with the police to catch Shane. Reports state, police set up a sting where Shane's ex would reach out to Shane and tell him she was traveling through town. Then she would wear a wire, and undercover police would be at the location. They needed him to confess again to her. So, in July 2000, Shane's ex called him and told him she was in town, and he agreed to meet her at the local airport. By this time, and it's unclear if he graduated from UK, but Shane was now working for his father doing computer work, and stayed in and out of trouble with a rap sheet that included several DUIs, traffic violations, and drug offenses. After they met up at an airport restaurant, they made small talk, and then Shane's ex decided to talk about the murder. She began by saying, quote-unquote, "Something has been bothering me. Something that you told me a long time ago. I wish you never had. And I need to know how you feel about it now." Shane knew what she was talking about and responded, quote-unquote, "I regret it." She then added, "Are you ever going to do anything about it? Just kind of let it go? I mean, can you live with it yourself?" Which Shane responded, quote unquote, "I don't have a choice, do I?" However, by this point, Shane was getting suspicious and made his ex promise him she wasn't setting him up, and said he was getting a weird vibe. His ex told him she never told anybody and quickly changed the subject to something else. But since she was wearing a wire when talking to Shane, detectives had all they needed to bring him in for questioning and to obtain a search warrant for his home. According to reports, the next day, detectives picked up Shane. At the station, Shane denied knowing Trent, and even though he acknowledged meeting up with his ex, he denied talking about Trent's murder. When detectives asked if he owned a gun, he said no. However, later on, when detectives claimed they were searching his home and had found a rifle that matched the one used in the murder, Shane said, quote unquote, "I forgot about that one, sir." He then added that he had told his ex about the murder to try and scare her, adding, quote unquote, "I've done a lot of drugs in my life, guys. You know I've done a lot of stupid things." Even though what he said wasn't a complete confession, it was enough for detectives to charge Shane with the murder of Trent DeGiro, 6 years after the crime. Reports state that Shane's bail was set at $1 million, and his father immediately paid the bail and hired the most expensive law firm in Kentucky. Almost 2 years later, in March 2002, Shane's trial began, and reports stated their star witness was Shane's ex. And the key evidence was the airport recording. When his ex took the stand, she testified and said, quote unquote, "He told me that he shot him, that he's the one that killed him. And he started telling me about, you know, sort of how he did it." And she added, "He had taken his gun and put it in a duffel bag and got on his mountain bike. And he had ridden it down the street and around something about going through someone's backyard." In response, Shane's pricey and high-powered lawyers tried hard to discredit her. According to reports, they first questioned her as to why she stayed with Shane for about a year after his confession, and also questioned just how incriminating that airport recording was, since he never directly admitted to killing Trent. However, Shane's ex stood her ground and said she was scared of what Shane would do if she told his secret so soon. When they realized their defense was waning, the defense decided to do a low blow and revealed to the court that they had obtained Shane's ex's diary from her college years. They then read some sexually explicit excerpts from it, trying to paint her as an unsavory woman. Eventually, the defense and prosecution rested, and just a short time after Shane Ragland's trial began, on March 27, 2002, Shane Ragland was found guilty of the murder of Trent DeGiro. And on April 26th, Shane was sentenced to 30 years in prison. However, the case was quickly appealed. Shane's attorneys argued that the prosecution had used an unreliable witness. Therefore, the case was then overturned by the Kentucky Supreme Court in 2005, and Shane was ordered to have a new trial. Reports state that due to this, the prosecution had to weigh the retrial, but during the first trial, Shane's ex had been put into witness protection, and she now had a new identity. She did not feel comfortable telling the story again, and without her, the case was not nearly as strong. Therefore, the district attorney struck a plea deal with Shane's lawyers to plead guilty to second-degree manslaughter, and he'd be sentenced to time served. Shane took the deal. On August 26, 2007, Shane pled guilty to manslaughter and was sentenced to time served, angering Trent's family. In response to Shane's new deal, the DeGiros filed a civil wrongful death lawsuit in 2007, and in 2008, the family was awarded $63 million. Even though the settlement wouldn't bring Trent back, everyone thought the case would finally be put to rest. And it was, except for Shane. You see, in the years after the settlement, Shane didn't pay almost any of the settlement amount and stayed in and out of trouble again with the law, including more drug and traffic charges. But in 2012, Shane's drug and traffic violations pretty much ended when in that year, he was involved in a car accident in Louisville, Kentucky that left him paralyzed. Due to this, a local Louisville charity for the disabled decided to raise funds for a special wheelchair for Shane. Until they were notified about his past murder conviction, and the charity decided to rescind their offer. Reports also state in 2014, Shane was arrested for domestic violence by another ex-girlfriend and was ordered to stay away from her and her children for a year. As of 2022, the DeGiros have not seen much or pretty much a dime of the settlement owed to them from Shane. And as of 2024, Shane Ragland has kept a relatively low profile, and his whereabouts are publicly unknown. The story of the murder of Trent DeGiro comes from the sources of the Lexington Herald Leader, the State Journal, Bowling Green Daily News, and others I'll put in the notes. All right, I know that one was kind of a twist and turn type episode, at least to me it was. I'm going to do like a short opinion piece. So I had heard about Trent DeGiro's murder years ago. I think I saw it on an Oxygen show, his case profiled, but I never really researched his murder until I started 90s Crime Time. Well, not even when I started, it was more of, I remember this case. Let me research more on this case. And so I brought it to you for this season five. And so when I was researching, I was like, oh, wow. Like, I didn't realize that it took them, or I had forgotten that it had taken detectives like 5 years to bring Trent's murder to justice. And it was Shane Ragland, and I had forgotten that it was all because he had pretty much lied about sleeping with some girl, and he lied on the wrong girl because, he shouldn't have lied on any girl, regardless of who she was, but he had lied on the fraternity that he was trying to get into, their president, and his girlfriend, and Trent told, like, I think he was kind of in the right to tell the SAE president, who's also a friend, that, hey, this guy Shane has been saying he slept with your girlfriend. And obviously the fraternity president was upset and blackballed Shane from getting into the fraternity that he so dreamed of getting into. But it's like, did you not know that the young lady was the fraternity president's girlfriend? Did you not know that? And then if you did know that, well, did you not care and you thought it was funny and a lie? And it came back to haunt you, came back to bite you in your behind, and you festered and got so mad that, you know, you thought it was Trent's friend at first and you were going to take revenge on him. So you thought that he, because he was also trying to get into SAE, that he was the one who told on you. But no, it was Trent who told on you. And you festered and festered and you decided you wanted to kill him for that. Like, I don't know what the motive was. I don't know if it's because he thought he would just kill him because he was just wanting him off the face of the earth, or he thought maybe he can get back into the good graces of the SAE president if Trent was gone. I don't know what the purpose of murdering Trent was for, because, you know, now what? Because, I mean, he did get away with it for 5 years until he confessed to the wrong one. And she had a heart eventually and went to her attorney friend. And he told the police. And, you know, luckily they had a good undercover operation. I read that the undercover operators actually were also in the airport with them and heard what he was saying to her and what she was saying to him in the airport. And they also had the wire, like I mentioned. And yeah, they got Shane. Now, I do not believe that. I mean, I think for me, I do wish that his original conviction of 30 years, you know, stood. But I guess, like I said, like he was able to overturn his conviction. The Kentucky Supreme Court overturned it. And, you know, the prosecution knew that they didn't have a big case after the ex-girlfriend understandably did not want to open her identity up again. So they were like, you know, we'll just make a plea. He'll be guilty forever. He'll just have time served, which I don't think was that great. But I do sort of think karma happened when he got into that car accident. Shane got into that car accident and became paralyzed. And it was kind of like crazy that the charity was like, oh, you know, we feel sorry for him. We'll give him a chair. And then once they found out that he had murdered Trent, they took it back. Wow. Like, that's karma. That's crazy. But I can only hope that the DeJuros are healing since, you know, Trent's murder. And luckily they got justice for their son, their family member. As for Shane, I'm hoping that he is going to stay out of trouble. But, you know, we can only hope. So that's it. Thank you for tuning in to another brand new episode of 90s Crime Time, and I hope you found this story interesting. If you liked what you heard and have not done so, please leave a review for 90s Crime Time. Hopefully a good one, but if not, I understand. I will try to get better. You can also follow 90s Crime Time on Instagram, where I frequently post other 90s stories, primarily on the weekend. And do not worry, I know I was gone for a while, and I will say I had a very long, month-long illness. Like, I had so many episodes planned to record, but I lost my voice. I still sound a little bit more nasal than normal, but I'm trying to, you know, I'm getting better, and I'm trying to be back on a frequent basis. But I plan on having new episodes back on a steady basis again. And look out for those, a brand new episode very soon. And with that, stay safe and healthy. Please stay healthy because, yeah, this illness still goes around and I had it for several weeks. But I will see you soon for a brand new episode of 90s Crime Time.